Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 2nd, 1998. In the Creekside room this morning, we have John Paul. It's session number 98-3 and is titled The Making of a Mystery Play. Let's listen in.
Filling our hours, so maybe we better get started here this morning, or maybe good if it would be. And I titled this session The Making of a Mystery Play. For a couple of reasons, partly because I thought it was just kind of a seductive title, and you could see that wasn't that didn't work. So we'll try a different title. I should say that my name is John Stephen Paul, and I'm a professor of theater and television arts at Valparaiso University in Indiana, in Northwest Indiana. And a part of my job, and it's been a wonderful part during the last 10 years, has been to be the director of a drama troupe called Soul Purpose. And his troupe has made its own plays, created its own plays, and has traveled all over the country, many thousands of miles, to perform these plays for churches in their worship services, most often in the place that particular Sunday of a sermon or homily. This group is currently made up of about 20 undergraduate students from the university. About half of those kids are majoring in theater and television arts. The other half come from different parts of the university, and Valpo is a national university, so they come from all parts of the country as well. We have come to a routine of having a two-week rehearsal period at the beginning of the year in August and September, and then we meet every Saturday morning from about 8:30 to 11:30. This is the way you test college students' commitment to the task. If they can make it there by 8:30 in the morning, you know you're dealing with somebody who's really seriously committed to the work. This is the one on the making of a mystery play, the drama one. And when we began working with this troupe, we were dramatizing some of the sermons of our campus pastor, David Carrot, who was at that time in his preaching career using stories, preaching story sermons. So we have a repertoire of eight plays, and four of them are adaptations of his sermons, dramatizations of his sermons. And then in more recent years, we have been trying to make our own plays within the group. And our process is that we choose a story and from the Bible, and then we will do an intensive period of Bible study, and off we will have a member of our theology department, a professor of theology, come in and speak with us, or a pastor that we know, someone who is an expert in the Bible, which I am not. And we will draw in commentaries and work like that, and then we will find ways to make connections between that story and our own lives and our own concerns and our own interests. Try and keep in mind that when we take this play on the road, if we do, we will have a much wider audience in terms of ages and concerns than the 4 years of undergraduate college students. So it's a very complicated process, and we do it prayerfully, and we do it deliberately, attempting to maintain the artistic integrity of the piece that we're working on, that we're trying to produce, and to make it a good proclamation of the gospel. And that is our particular mystery. The old mystery plays, which I'll talk about in detail in a moment, were called mystery plays because they were attached to groups of people who had a particular trade. And that trade was called secret or a mystère in French. And so the mystery play, it means that you have a group of people who know how to do something in particular and are able to contribute that gift to a given enterprise. And we'll come back to that. I just laid out a little extremely simplified history of a period of Western theater and drama here. For those of you who know this story, please excuse the simplification, but this period of Greek and Roman plays, we call the classical period. There we're talking about 5th century BCE Greece and the great tragedians Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides and the comedian Aristophanes. And then later, in about 200 BC, around there, you have a period of flourishing of Roman playwrights, especially comedians, Plautus and Terence. Plautus, the Roman comedian, developed a kind of formula for doing comedy, which lives on today in our situation comedy on television. Almost all of the comedy that sells these days can be traced back to 200 BCE Rome. Not really to Greece, but to Rome. That's an interesting story in itself. And then, of course, the classical civilization comes to an end, falls, and there's and one of the things that happens with the ascendancy of the Christian church and when it becomes formalized then with the Emperor Constantine is a kind of revulsion against the theater. And against actors. Actors and theater people had become associated with the vilest parts of civilized life, and maybe even that stretching it to call it civilized life. But things were done on stage, the stories go, that make some of our entertainments today seem, if not mild, at least not unprecedented. Killings of people on stage, sex on stage, in general, the kind of stuff that made early church fathers like Tertullian speak out very general condemnatory diatribes against theater and actors. So to be a Christian actor means to have your roots in history, in times when that was not only an oxymoron, but a kind of sin. It would have been an unforgivable sin to be an actor if you were purported to be a Christian, and actors could not be buried in sacred ground for a long time. Even the great French comedian Molière was not allowed to be buried in a cemetery with a Christian service. And, of course, some of that anti-theatrical prejudice and that strong feeling against actors continues today. So to say you are both a Christian and an actor is problematic for some people. How is that possible? And one of the things that we are doing with Soul Purpose, I think, in a small way, is trying to reconcile that incongruity. And we are not alone in that. There's a very large organization growing all the time called Christians in Theater Arts, who had their meeting, by the way, last week at Seattle Pacific University in Seattle. Thousands of people across the country are joining that organization to try to heal up that ancient breach between being Christian and being an actor. But, you know, there's precedent for that, too, and that's what I want to talk about here today. Here I have sort of the Renaissance on the other side, especially the English Renaissance and the Spanish Renaissance, where the great plays of Shakespeare and his contemporaries and Spanish playwrights, which was the other, sometimes we don't hear too much about, the Spanish contemporaries of Shakespeare, and they are great plays. Well, then you have this period here in the middle. How is it possible? It's so amazing that after the church fathers would have condemned so generally the theater, it would have been the church itself where theater would have found its own renaissance. It's wrong to say that there were only religious plays in the Middle Ages. There were a lot of secular entertainments, all kinds of sort of combination of drama and circus and folk plays, and it was a very rich period for theater. The human race has always done theater. It's always been one of its great activities. It's frightening to see it fade now in the age of television and computers. But the first thing that began to happen, it seems, in monasteries was something called that's been called liturgical troping. And it seems to have been as simple as taking one of the lessons of the day or a scriptural passage that might have been part of the, what we would not have, what at one time called the introit or the gradual, some part of the liturgy, and dramatizing it in the sense that people, brothers, in the monastery would have taken on roles. There might have been some attention given to costuming, and there was certainly dialogue, usually sung dialogue. So this became part of the liturgy, and the first one of these that we trace is called the Quem Quaeritis. Whom do you seek? Which is what the angel said to the Marys at the tomb. And that's the first one that's been identified, that there would have been one of the brothers playing an angel, and three of the brothers playing the women come to the tomb, and there was this simple dialogue, whom do you seek, Christians? We seek Jesus Christ. He is not here. And that was the first liturgical trope. There's another one called the Pastores, about the shepherds and the angels. And we know about these because in about something like 975, a bishop in England decided we better regulate this stuff because some of it's not being done very well. It's already starting to get a little bit too free and out of hand. So there's something called the Regularis Concordiae. We're going to get together on the rules for this. The first great stage directions of the Middle Ages. And in very detailed way, the Quem Quaeritis trope is spelled out. This is how it should be done. And in England, we will abide by this, according to Bishop Ethelwald. And so then follows a period where there was a lot of liturgical troping, a lot of liturgical sung drama. Once you start to open an idea like that, of course, I don't know exactly what happened there, but it's not hard to imagine that this must have been considered a great new thing to be able to do this, to actually begin to impersonate parts of the scripture for liturgical purposes. And there's a huge two-volume work by Carl Jung called The Drama of the Medieval Church, in which he talks about this liturgical drama. Well, this is a very short history lesson here because we want to get to one of the plays that we're working on. But then following that early stuff, we come to these three M's, the three M types of plays. Miracle plays, mystery plays, and morality plays. Like any history, it sort of depends on who's telling the story here, and the documentary evidence is sketchy. There was a period where it seemed that there were sort of these 19th century historians of the drama who wanted to show that first there were tropes, and then there were mystery plays, and then there were miracle plays, and finally there were morality plays, and then there was Shakespeare. And it's not that simple. But there were a lot of these things around. And the miracle plays tended to be plays about saints and prophets. And one of the great ones was the play of Adam, which was done in France. And the actual town now escapes me. But it was done on the steps of one of the great cathedrals. And it was actually a play in which Adam and Eve and the serpent and everyone got to speak about the story of the creation and fall of man. The play of Adam. That comes in about 1290, just at the end of the 13th century in France. I'm sorry, I had forgotten the name of the city. And France then continues to be a center for this kind of activity, and France had great passion plays. The kind of passion play that still survives in Oberammergau really began in France. They became the model where there would be huge stages in which all the places of the passion story would be set in a row, and the audiences would come. These were usually in the marketplace, and they would watch from the triumphal entry into Jerusalem all the individual episodes through the crucifixion done very realistically to the Ascension and to Pentecost, I believe, although I'm not sure. I know it goes to the Ascension. So these great passion pageants in which whole towns would contribute to the acting, the production, scenery, props, etc. Now something else happens in England, the mystery play. And it's proper to speak of them as cycles, these mystery cycles, because they were a series, and we have these, they'll expand. They were a series of as many as 50 plays. Each play was done on a particular story of God's great plan for the universe. The first play was the creation play. There would be a Garden of Eden play. There was a killing of a Abel play, the Cain and Abel play. Then it would go to there'd be a Noah play. And the exact number of plays and the specific plays would change, but they would do them over the course of 2 or 3 days, and I'm sure some of you have heard these stories. Each of these plays would be done on its own wagon, like a float that they call the pageant. And they would bring these pageants through the center of these towns. They would do the play, and then that pageant would move on, and the next one would move into place, and they'd do the next cycle. And so in the course of a 3-day period, you could see the whole history of the universe according to the Bible. The church supported this. It was a way of educating unlettered laity, and the church controlled, and usually the authors were monks or people who were learned and were acceptable to the Catholic Church, which was sponsoring these at that time. It was before the English Renaissance, of course. And some of these little plays are just gems in and of themselves. I got to go to Chester last summer, where they still revive the Chester cycle every 5 years. And they bring in theater groups from 100 miles around, from schools, and youth groups from different churches and cathedrals, and still do this great play. This is where these cycles took place. They still do them in York occasionally. Chester was the one where I was. Coventry had a famous cycle. Have you seen it there?
I've seen the Coventry cycle.
Wakefield, which has some of the most delightful plays, they're still producible now. London had a cycle, and there were probably others. And they would do them once a year. And each of those plays was produced then by a particular trade guild, which had a secret to contribute. So the people who, the goldsmiths, for example, would do the Visit of the Magi, right? Because they knew how to do gold, and they knew how to make those gifts. The water people would do Noah. There are records that attach each one of these plays to the particular trade guilds. And it became, not only a religious event, but it became a civic event. It became a kind of way of unifying these towns around one great story to be told each year. There was a play called The Harrowing of Hell, which would follow, of course, the crucifixion, in which Jesus would go down into the mouth of hell, and everybody played devils, and they dressed up, and they made fire come out of Leviathan's mouth, and it must have been a great spectacle. Well, the church started to pull back from this a little bit because it was getting to be too theatrical. The church started to pull back from this. Of course, in England, you have this long story of Catholic and Protestant competition and conflict. And finally, in the year 1558, when Elizabeth I ascends the throne, there will be no more religious plays. They were too incendiary. People were starting to fight about whose doctrine we were going to have here. Was it going to be Rome, or was it going to be Was it going to be the Reformation doctrine? And was it going to be Catholic or Protestant? And then one of the really sad things happens here. When Oliver Cromwell takes over and there's the English Revolution in the middle of the 17th century, all of the pre-Reformation imagery is destroyed and there's nothing left of it in England. And so to a certain extent, all this stuff is buried now in the sort of ash heaps of the past. One comes to hate those iconoclasts, even though, of course, as a Lutheran, I feel sort of associated with that movement in some ways. And I should say the last M is, of course, the morality play. The most famous one of these is Everyman, in which Everyman learns that he's going to die, and he doesn't have much time, but he's given a chance to take, sort of do the rounds once to see who will come with him on the road into death. And all of his friendship, family, beauty, strength, his faculties, they, which had been his friends all the time, say, we're not going with you into death. And on the other side, he has his good deeds, discretion, confession, these things. All of these concepts become characters then. And it's a great, great story about, what are you going to be able to take with you, and what are you not going to be able to take with you? There was a series of these plays, Good and Evil, battling for the soul of one individual. Well, we have taken, in Soul Purpose and I, have taken our cue from these mystery cycles. At this point, we don't have enough plays to do a cycle. It would be fun to think that sometime we might. But some of the individual plays are very interesting. The Abraham and Isaac plays, there's a famous one with Wakefield title called The Second Shepherd's Play. These plays are available. If you're trying to get yourself inspired to do religious drama, I recommend them to you at the library. They're just fun and very interesting to read through. So, what we have been doing while we've been here, Soul Purpose, in the last few weeks, is to begin to work on our next project. And every year we set before us several projects and see which of those interests us as a part of the Bible to work on. And the story that has kept coming back to the table is the story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. It is, of course, a very dramatic story, and it's a story that speaks to us, I think, as people who are tempted. Maybe it speaks in a special way to college students who find themselves in wilderness. What am I? How did I get here? Where's the end of this? Will I ever graduate? And then what will happen to me? And temptations do come along. So perhaps it's not unusual or hard to figure out why they would be drawn to this story. But we're going to use the Luke version of the story of the temptation. And as you know, this gospel and one of the Gospels is always used on the first Sunday of Lent, and we tie our plays to the lectionary. We try to prepare plays that can be used as part of the worship service. And so let's just have a look at this. It's Luke 4, you'll remember, of course, that this follows hard upon Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist. And it's important to keep that in mind. So, Marian, would you read there, beginning just at the beginning of chapter 4?
Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit in the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. He ate nothing at all during these days, and when they were over, he was famished. The devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become a loaf of bread." Jesus answered him, "It is written, one does not live by bread alone." Then the devil led him up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And the devil said to him, "To you I will give their glory and all this authority, if it has been given over, for it has been given over to me, and I will give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours." Jesus answered him, "It is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him."
Okay, did you take over there?
Sure. Then the devil took him to Jerusalem and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to protect you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone." Jesus answered him, "It is said, do not put the Lord your God to the test." When the devil had finished every test, he departed from him until an opportune time.
Okay, now let's just talk about this for just a moment. What is this story about, if I can ask that kind of general question? What is this story about?
It's about power.
Power? Want to say more?
Mm-hmm. I could, but...
Well, go ahead.
There are different kinds of areas of power and authority that he's being tempted to yield in order to get. So it's payment, and if he'll do this, there's all kinds of ways that he can compromise who he is. So it's personal integrity versus public power, or even in some cases private power. But and not least of which is just the power to survive, which is bread. Mm-hmm. There's more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It seems like it's a lot about discretion and faith. The story of the temporary or immediate gratification is being denied here, and it's, he's also not, it's a lot of faith because it says, do not put your Lord to the test. So it has a lot to do with the way gratification.
And it's like we heard in the Bible study this morning, it's girls, girls.
Yeah.
Thank you for trying.
I mean, we're only here for
No, the outside windows are not open, so those inside windows just
door.
Don't make any difference.
You probably need to close those.
It's the picture back saw. It's just, we'll open this one and close those.
Sorry about all this. It's okay. Oh, now he's
going to quit,
so that's fine. Right. But it's like Bob said this morning, this is... another enactment in a very specialized way of the wilderness experience of the Israelites who were taken out of, who left Egypt and who were for 40 years tested, and Jesus is for 40 days having all these tests for a specific reason, for us to learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe for Jesus to learn. I've always kind of wondered about that. If this is also for Jesus to know who he himself was.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, is this just God's big object lesson, you know? Did he make this happen so that all of us would have something to read 2,000 years later and make sense of? Or are we really talking about one person being stuck out there, you know, and having to deal with the wilderness?
Could be both.
I think
it's a story, too, of exploitation. The devil moves in and he exploits the whole situation. I mean, that's true in our own lives too.
Mm-hmm.
He waits until that weak moment and then he comes crashing in.
in one form or another, this always comes up, you know, at least in liturgical churches on the first Sunday in Lent, no matter what gospel you're in. And I find it year after year after year, one thing that happens to me is how both at the same time subtle and absolutely, what's the opposite of subtle? You know, just how weighing you over the head, the temptations themselves are. You know, that they're really, they're everything, and then yet they're just these little, which is characteristic.
You know, if we could take ourselves to the place where Walt was talking yesterday with words that you really get into, and this is what acting is, it's taking those words and turning it into action. But when we read, if we're able to put ourselves into that situation, and actually, how would you feel if you hadn't eaten for that long a time? Oh my heavens! I mean, it's, to me, I can hardly believe that Jesus turned down the offer.
I just read a book called Quarantine by an author named Jim Crace, C-R-A-C-E, about this. And he goes into great detail about what would happen to somebody if they didn't eat or drink for 40 days.
Yeah.
Kind of horrible.
Oh, it's a terrible
graphic
yeah.
description of this.
Yeah,
would they survive?
No. Well, I don't want to tell you how the novel comes out, but according to Crace, he says,
Yes, I know.
Now, one of the things that we would ask ourselves, one of the things that I ask myself, okay, if this is a gospel to be read on the first Sunday in Lent, you know, where's the good news in this story? Where is the gospel? And so, as we read this play now, which is in draft form, I'd like you to have that question in the back of your head too, because it's very important. To our process. What is the good news? What is the gospel in this story? We've been talking for quite a long time about how to get into this story to begin to dramatize it. And quite fortuitously, I guess, maybe it's all God helping us in this way, we read Frank Rogers' chapter on discernment as part of this Holden experience. And I don't know if you have had a chance to read that chapter, but he tells the story in there, and Frank was here, fortunately, and he's been sitting with us, and so we have his permission to use this story, about a woman who is married for quite some time and has several children, to a husband who one day comes home and says, "I'm moving out." And he's going to move in with his assistant at the office, who's considerably younger than he is. Okay, not a news story. But Frank Rogers picks this story up then when, after 8 months, this woman has started to get her life together, and the husband calls up and says, "I want to come home now." And she is really back on the road to being a whole person, an independent person who can take care of herself. Well, what does she do? She's Catholic. Divorce is wrong. She feels deeply wronged by this and has begun her life. What should she do? Take him back immediately? Or shall she say, "No, you know, this story is over. We're going to start a new one now." First of all, I urge you to read that story in the chapter on discernment. Frank then talks about ways in which we answer very hard questions for ourselves. What should I do here? And he takes us through the spiritual exercises of Ignatius Loyola, and also he makes reference to the Quakers and their way of doing discernment. Well, this was a way into this play, into the temptation story for us, because we began to think now of Jesus and his own discernment process in the wilderness. And was there some parallel here? Is that what this story is also about? In addition to what you've been saying, Jesus' own going into the wilderness to find out what to do, to listen for the voice of God. What we would normally do now is to worked through several drafts of this play. I think that we will draft this play probably 7 or 8 times before we're ready to perform it. We're at draft 3 here, okay? So you're really in on a fairly early part of the process. And so I want you to feel free to respond to this relative to the story after we've read it. Will it become a play to be used as a sermon in a church service? I don't know. We're trying not to box ourselves into that particular format. I'd be interested to know what you think. How would you feel if this were your sermon on the first Sunday of Lent? So we're at the same old point here. We have 4 copies for 6 parts. And the characters are Janet, who is 38 years old, mother of 4 children, the oldest of which is 12, and she's been married for 13 years to Adam, who is 36 years old. Sandy is Janet's neighbor and friend. She's about 45 years old. And Derek is 40, a college friend of Janet's. Seth, 18, is a waiter. He is Derek's son, but he has no memory of his father. And Luke also appears in this play, who is, at this point anyway, the gospel writer. That's one question that I have later for you. Okay, now, Dave, if you would read Derek, and Carol, right? Would you read Sandy? And you'll share one. Okay. And Derek, if you would read, please, Adam.
That's the easiest of all, 15 years ago.
That's the magic of the theater. And you read Adam.
You're 15 years.
And you read Janet.
15 years. No, I just lost 15 years.
Oh, it's been rejuvenated.
Dave, would you and Carol trade places?
I have a son named Derek, so that's a real good. Yeah. How he spent
your life. So that Sandy's sitting next to Janet.
You bet.
Okay.
You use the same script.
Yep.
She's no problem.
Okay. And okay, and you read Seth. Okay, now do we have a Janet? Yes. We have Adam, that's you, Eric. We have Sandy, Carol. We have Davis, Derek, right? And we have Seth. And I will read Luke, the gospel writer, and I'll read the stage direction so we also understand what's going on here. Okay? Now, let's assume that at the beginning, sometime in the church service, this gospel has been read. All right, so the whole congregation has heard this gospel read at the time of gospel reading. And the first section goes quite rapidly here. It has a very fast pace.
Well, I'm here now.
What am I supposed to do?
Well, I came all the way up here, God, and I'm waiting.
I took the time off. What do you want me to do?
I'm in the wilderness, okay? Now what?
Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit in the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil.
40 days? Are you kidding? That's 6 weeks.
I haven't got that kind of time.
I need to know this now.
I want to do this now.
I've got to have this now.
Now, Lord, now.
Scene 1, Janet's kitchen. Janet is speaking to Sandy, her friend, who is in her own kitchen.
Now, he called and said he wants to come home now.
Janet, that's nuts.
I know.
You're not thinking about it, are you? You're thinking about it, aren't you? I don't believe you.
He's my husband.
He's the guy who deserted you and your kids 8 months ago and moved in with the girl at the office.
But he says that's over now and he made a mistake.
Oh, fine. Just when you start to get a life, he wants to tear off a big hunk of it for himself. Tell him to shove off.
Sandy, divorce is wrong.
Living with that liar is wrong. You can't do this. You can't let him back.
I won't. At least not for a while. I need some time.
But you know the answer now.
No, I don't. I go back and forth on this. First, this seems like the most important thing. Then that. I've never had a real job until this one. But I've never seen the kids this unhappy. Sure, I've had more good days than bad ones in the last 8 months, but the bad ones have been absolutely hell.
Have you called my therapist? He can help you with the bed.
No, I'm going to take some time. Can you keep the kids for a while, just a week or two?
Well, sure, I guess. Where will you go?
Just away. Maybe a park or a big city, somewhere where I can be by myself.
What about your job?
I can work it out. I need to do this. I'll bring the kids over tonight, okay?
Well, I'm here now.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
Well, I came all the way out here, God, and I'm waiting.
I'm taking the time off. I hope you'll tell me what to do.
I must be in the wilderness, but now what?
What?
What? What, Lord? What?
He ate nothing at all during those days, and after they were over, he was famished. Scene 2, a restaurant in San Francisco. Janet and Derek sitting at a table with a somewhat impatient waiter, Seth, waiting for a response.
What?
What? I'm sorry.
Sorry, that's Seth.
What do you want?
What do you want, ma'am?
That's the question, isn't it? I mean vegetarian.
Janet, this is a seafood restaurant. We're on Fisherman's Wharf, remember?
I know. And I am hungry. Pasta primavera, please.
And to drink?
Water, please, for now. Thank you.
I just can't get over it. I haven't seen you for, what, 15 years? And today I bump into you in the city. How long have you been here?
Almost 3 weeks.
What are you doing in that neighborhood?
Research.
Research on what? I'm sorry, if it's none of my business, let's talk about...
No, it's a fair question. I wish I had a good or a better answer. I work for a feeding center back home. I'm a grant writer. I was looking at facilities.
That's as good an excuse as any for a trip to San Francisco.
I guess.
Remember the last time we were here?
How could I ever forget it? Life is strange.
Tell me about it. Really? I mean it. Where have you been for the last 15 years?
No, it's not all that interesting.
Try me.
The waiter brings Derek a glass of white wine.
Well, I had a big wedding, which you didn't come to.
It was in Topeka.
It's as good an excuse as any. A big church wedding and a 16-place setting and 4 automatic bread maker receptions.
Tony and Tina?
Exactly. Then 4 kids in 6 years. I have pictures.
You look great, Janet.
It costs money to raise kids and keep wifey happy at home. Adam has a good job. I mean, it pays a lot. Great benefits. Long hours. It worked for a while. A good while. Then he discovered other benefits at the office. A very pretty 20-something assistant. Long, short story. He decided to change our lives. I was not consulted, only informed 8 months ago. Don't worry, he said. You'll have all the money you need. I was devastated, flattened. I cried for a month. I was depressed for another month. And then, you know, I started to get it together. I went to church for the first time in 5 years. I started volunteering for the church's feeding center. I wrote a grant for the center, and we got it. The church hired me, a half-time assistant, just to write grants. When the director took another job, I became interim director of St. Anthony's Emergency Food Center.
And now you're in San Francisco having dinner with me. A great story.
But we're not anywhere near the end. The plot thickens.
Yes?
Last month, 8 months after, honey, I need a change, he calls me and says he wants to come back home. He loves me. He loves the kids. He's learned a lot about himself. He'd like us all to be together again.
I've heard this one before.
Really? It sure took me by surprise.
Men, especially men of a certain age, are creatures of impulse. Show them something that looks better than what they've got and they want it. Now. They grab for it and they deal with the trade-offs later. They save time that way, and time is something they think they're running out of.
I'm tempted to do that too. How often in life do you get a good excuse to start fresh? A new life with focus and purpose and satisfaction? Wrong, my man done me wrong. Who would blame me for moving on alone?
Not me. and not anyone who counts.
What about me? Wouldn't I blame myself?
Learn to forgive yourself. To err is human, to forgive divine.
And what about my kids? You have no idea what it's like to be asked questions like, Mom, why are you leaving now that Dad just got here? Or, Mom, why aren't you and Daddy wearing your rings anymore?
You're right, I have no idea.
I don't want to act out of impulse and momentary emotion, so I'm here to do research. I desperately need information to help me make a decision.
And the devil said to him, if you are the Son of God, command this stone to become a loaf of bread.
Jed, I don't believe that things happen by simple coincidence. You came to San Francisco. We met according to some plan. Now that we're together, let me help you with your research.
I'm listening.
Let's begin by not making this our last dinner together for another 15 years, huh? The food is really great in San Francisco. Let's spend some time trying different cuisine this week, like we used to do before I had him in Topeka. You know what I mean?
The waiter arrived with the food. Jesus answered him, it is written, one does not live by bread alone.
Pastor Pimodoro for you, sir, and Pastor Primavera for the lady. Would you care for anything to drink, ma'am?
I can't do this. I'm sorry, Derek.
And she exits.
More wine, sir?
Well, I'm here now.
Great idea to get away and all, but now what am I supposed to do?
I went all the way down there, God, and I'm still waiting.
I've lived in the wilderness for 3 weeks, so what?
Why did I do that?
Let's see, 3 times 7 is only...
I think I wanted that. I think I still want that. Why?
19 to go.
The devil led him up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world.
Why is this so hard?
Why does this take so long?
Why, Lord? Why?
Scene 3. The arrival area of an airport. Adam, pacing. Janet enters with a carry-on bag.
Why are you here?
To take you home.
No, Sandy's picking me up. How did you know I was coming in?
I finally got it out of Sandy, like pulling teeth.
Oh.
You'd think we were in the witness protection program or something.
Adam, I'm not going home with you. You're not coming home. You haven't moved back, have you? Because if you have, I'll...
No, I haven't, but I'm here now. Could we just talk? It's so good to see you alone.
Okay, but not for long. I'm beat.
So where have you been for 3 weeks?
Adam, that's mine.
Okay, I'm sorry. Janet, I want this separation or whatever it's called to be over now.
You want everything now. You want it out now. You want to come home now. You can't always have everything now.
I'd get down on my knee, but I wrecked it doing jazzercise.
Oh, I'm wincing.
I'll give you anything you want. I'll give you anything you want, the world. Let's go on a trip, Hawaii or Paris. Right, let's start with Paris.
It looks by and continue.
Okay, let's buy a new house. The old one has too many bad memories now.
We
can have a gourmet kitchen and a jacuzzi. And let's get a diamond wedding ring. Let's get diamond wedding rings like we always said. We'll start over. I'll make it up to you.
Adam, no, I...
Wait, don't say no. Forget the house.
And the devil said to him, to you I will give their glory and all this authority, for it has been given over to me, and I give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours.
Adam...
Do you want to work? I'll get you a job, an assistant vice presidency, in marketing. I can do it. I'm the boss. Just be my wife again like before.
I have a job.
Doing what?
I'm the interim director of St. Anthony's Emergency Food Center. I feed poor people.
Oh, well, great. Janet, tell me what I can do. I'm circling in the wilderness here. I don't know what to say or do or think. I need you. What do I have to do?
There's nothing you can do. I have to do it. And I can't yet because I don't know what it is.
What about the kids? Don't they deserve a stable two-parent household like we have?
Adam, how can
Sandy enters.
Go away, Sandy. This is my wife and none of your business.
You don't know who she is, but I know who you are.
Adam makes a frustrated, threatening move towards Sandy, but he stops himself.
Go ahead, do it. That'll make all of this easier.
You're mine, aren't you?
Jesus answered him, "It is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him." Janet looks for a long moment at Adam and then turns to Sandy.
Can you help me with my bag?
And they exit.
Well, I'm here now.
I'm totally lost, I think.
I've been at this for 6 weeks now.
6 weeks and 4 days to be exact.
Where are you taking me, Lord?
Then the devil took him to Jerusalem.
Jerusalem? You're kidding!
Where?
And placed him on the pinnacle of the temple.
Where?
Saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here."
From where?
Scene 4. Janet is at her desk at St. Anthony's Emergency Food Center. It is 11:30 p.m. Sandy is at home. They speak on the telephone.
From where?
From St. Anthony's.
What are you doing there at 11:30 at night? Where are the kids?
I'm catching up on some paperwork. My mother's home with the kids.
Oh, well, what are you doing calling me at 11:30 at night?
Sandy, you called me.
I did? How did I get this number?
I'm having my calls forwarded, so you rang?
Janet, I'm just going to say it because I have to say it. Every day that goes by, I'm sure that you should make this separation permanent and go it alone.
We've had this discussion before, and you know how I feel.
You may think you know how you feel, but that's only fear. Once you're on your own, that fear will fade day by day. I know. I've been there.
Divorce is a sin.
Says who?
God, the church.
Is that me? The church. After all the work you've done for that food center, they'd have nerve. You're a saint. God knows that. God will take care of you.
He will command his angels concerning you to protect you. On their hands, they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone.
What about the children?
The sooner the children learn the world isn't perfect, the better. Look, I'm so tired I can't see straight, but real soon I want you to have lunch with me and a friend. She's a first-rate divorce lawyer. Sweetheart, you've got all the cards in this hand. This is your chance. You're ready now. We've got silence on it. Janet, are you okay? Are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Good night and thanks. Should I see this?
When the devil had finished every test, he departed from him until an opportune time. Janet sighs, picks up a book from her desk, and pages through it.
Is this the good news or the bad news?
Am I finally out of the wilderness? Can I see the border?
Have I found my way? Am I happy now?
Is this your voice, Lord? Am I hearing you?
How would I know? There are so many.
Well, I'm here now, at least.
Janet puts down the book, picks up a piece of paper with a phone number on it, picks up the phone and dials deliberately. She gets an answer.
Adam, can we talk?
What time is it? Sweetheart, it's so wonderful to hear your voice. You want to talk now? I'll be right home.
No, not at home. At St. Anthony's. I know it's late, but I'd like to talk to you here. You know where the church is, don't you?
Sure, I'll be right there. Is this good news or bad news?
Adam, give me about 40 minutes, okay?
40 minutes. Anything you say.
Janet turns back to the Bible. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free.
Is the Spirit of the Lord upon me? Is this the year of the Lord's favor? One of those kind of plays. You don't know what's going to happen.
That's tomorrow's session. Beginnings, middles, and endings.
Stephen, minister at our church, and currently I'm dealing with a woman supporting a woman who's in just this situation. And I'm sure that in the congregation there are many, many others. And I can just imagine this hitting all, and if it wasn't happening to you, you know somebody's happening. I think it would just be, the congregation would be stunned. And I think that the service would have to be followed by a new discussion. they couldn't go out without.
Well, I think that's the question. Maybe it shouldn't be in a service. Maybe it should be in some kind of discussion group.
But people, you know, the a lot of people who need to hear it wouldn't come if they knew that was what it was. They would avoid it.
But if the play is trying to show temptations, I simply wouldn't have been tempted at all to go back to that jerk the way he's talking to me. Now, the temptation to take care of my kids would be high, high, high. To me, that would be the pain, what is best for my kids. But when he recites all that stuff about diamond rings in Paris and everything, that isn't, that doesn't,
that's real. A bullshit answer. That's not the real answer. I was trying to match the temptations. I mean, so you've got a dinner and a kind of security for her in the first temptation, that's sort of the bread. And you've got, and then you've got the children and the home. I mean, there's sort of two securities and...
Kingdoms.
Kingdoms, yeah.
Family, yeah. Work.
Yeah, and work. And I mean, it feels like a... she isn't Jesus, and the temptations aren't as great, but they're comparable. That's not bad. That's not bad. The other thing is that as we were talking about mystery cycles, I was thinking, boy, you know, why would you pick this? Because the hardest thing in the world is to present demonic stuff realistically. And I think you've done a good job. I think it's easier to take a modern take on this than this, to go back here and show... and show a devil, because he ends up being just a comic figure,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Instead of taken seriously. So that and the temptations come in the form of a former boyfriend who could, in fact, well, I mean, we don't know for sure whether you're single, and so the temptation might be to flee to you as another. I don't think that's shown, but clearly you're asking for, or Derek is asking for. Further suppers together, and
right.
maybe the
kind of exciting romantic life that she's never had.
Yeah,
that's sort of the idea of the bread there, and yeah. That's why San Francisco, I suppose, is one going to choose one's own city here, Indianapolis. You know, wonderful.
You know what Derek offered her was the same thing that her husband offered her, a new house.
But her husband failed, is offering her again, but
yeah,
he's
offering her again, but
she has cause to doubt.
Yeah, she's cause to doubt. So both men are wooing her by material things.
Yeah, that's useful, because we were trying to raise that to a different level and to think in terms of not only gratification of hunger, but trying to get to the level of kingdom there. You know, what are our kingdoms? What could we be control of? I'll make you president of Valparaiso University. You know, I'll make you the queen of your house. You know, I'll start you on a career. You know, you name it. So I was trying to raise that to a different level.
Fred's Bible study this morning was a very interesting take on the bread temptation, where Craig is saying that the real key to that temptation is, you know, is taking care of all your needs. Now, if you could do this, if you could change stone into bread, that's a dream. You know, to never have to worry again about whatever you want, yeah, stuff. Yeah. You know, you'll have all the stuff you need, and everybody will have enough stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, that could be maybe pushed a little bit more. You know,
but enough is never enough.
Right, exactly.
I think the sticky part in the modern text is
is a and in fact, my character kind of speaks to another temptation that might be a good, but it might be not so good, and that is the temptation to say a therapist can straighten this out. Mm-hmm. But modern marriages and modern people think that before you say yes or no, you know, in something like this, that the thing that will be the salvation of this relationship will be a long-term therapy in marriage therapy for the couple together. And I'm thinking that since that isn't addressed, there might be, you know, there might be some flaw in its makeup, because that would be an automatic. I mean, maybe the husband himself would say, "I'll even go to therapy with you," or you know, something like that. Uh-huh. I don't know. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So you can show
that's interesting.
That he looks like he's had a change, so it is a true. Because this way, he doesn't really look like he's changed much.
Okay, right. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's right. I think Adam needs some help here.
Mm-hmm. And speaking,
like, so it'll be more temptation.
And speaking of, you know, from a lot of experience with these situations, you know, what makes the decision easier for a lot of people is if one or the other spouse refuses to
go to therapy.
Therapy.
Well, yeah, he could say, after one visit to Sandy's therapist, you know, say, "I don't need this. I mean, I can't. I don't need this."
But I like at the end having it very ambiguous.
Oh, yeah.
Because as a pastor, I've been in, and in fact, I've talked to you, John, about, you know, what I don't like a lot about a lot of liturgical or chancel dramas is that they make the answer is so easy. You know, like here, you know, and you could make this into a Janet, whatever, meets a person and says, "Oh, well, if you just accept Jesus into your heart, you know, then it'll all be okay." Nor, on the other hand, can you answer it the other way, that, you know, the right and faithful thing would be just to leave that louse, you know, and sin boldly and ta da ta da. I like that, you know, that very ambiguous ending. And yet, you ask, where's the good news? You know, if this, to me, would replace proclamation for the day, there would need to be some other device, I think, of a narrator or whatever, that would somehow say that in the wilderness, yet, even though we don't, you know, the Holy Prayer, you know, even though we don't know where we go, that God is there in the wilderness. There would need to be some other device. And I'm thinking of, for example, that, you know, that woman or whatever who's in church that day, you know, and has absolutely no idea that this play is going to be, you know, is she interpreting this to be the church is telling me I've got to go back to my husband, or is the church telling me the other thing is playing to tell me the other thing? And as it ends very ambiguously, the good news to that person who is literally in shock needs to be, Jesus is with you right now in your answer.
Well, whatever answer it is.
Yeah, exactly. The next draft, I think, that I'm working on now is making Luke into a real person who is the companion who is in a position to say that.
That's what I wanted to. I wanted her to have one other companion doing more than Luke was doing.
She's a pretty lonely person.
More solidifying the good news. That's what I wanted.
Who picks
up
the luggage?
Who picks up the luggage? Sandy, now.
Okay, I mean, that was a question that I had.
That's a good question.
I wasn't real sure, but I knew that stage direction would tell that. But Sandy picks up the luggage.
The other thing I was trying to do at the airport. The airport scene, Sandy gets out of the luggage. The other thing I like is the possibility that now Janet is going to begin a ministry here. Not that she's going to become an ordained minister in the church, but that there might actually be a ministry to the poor, which would take her through the next several years.
And this
of her
is
life.
One of my points. The temptations have to be more real, because I think one of the glories of this Jesus story is that Jesus went through real temptations. If this is just fake stuff, then it isn't the message that I think it gives us, that Jesus went through it, and that helps me, that I can go through it. And I don't think the temptations, like I said, I thought he was too much of a jerk, and you've already talked about that. You want to make him more reason why I may be tempted. But Derek needs to be more tempting to me, too.
Yeah.
Derek, you weren't very tempting to me. Because
you weren't looking at me. You were handsome. You were doing this without script.
What did they know?
But
he puts down the work I do, where she says, she's proud. I work for a feeding center. I'm a grant writer. I'm looking at facilities. Mm-hmm. And his line, it's a good excuse. Boy, Derek was gone for my interest at that point.
Yeah.
He has to be something that is also interested in feeding poor people. So I
that
find
would
a connection.
Or at least charming in my
I'm pretty discerning. I have to believe that you really care.
Yeah, the idea of the temptation is it's just what you want. It seems perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I know
you
who this. I know how to do this.
But I think even in the biblical story, I mean, one of the neat things about those temptations is that. There isn't, ostensibly, there is nothing wrong with those things that Jesus is tempted
exactly.
to. I mean, what's wrong with bread after you fast?
Right.
What's wrong with having the power to woo nations or to be secure? And I think that it reminds me of the wonderful line in T.S. Eliot's play of the martyrdom of
Merton Cathedral.
Yeah. Merton Cathedral, where it says the right thing to go to martyrdom, the right thing for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
That's so you get at the real gutsy stuff underneath there.
Yeah.
Say,
yeah.
Well, this may look good, but it's the wrong reason.
Yeah.
Well, I thought since it was a play about temptation, I thought that the characters of Sandy and Derek were I found them both succumbing to a certain temptation, in that Derek sort of saw this as sort of a good time to strike, am I? He was tempted. Here's a woman in a vulnerable situation.
Absolutely, yeah.
So he was tempted there. And Sandy seems to me like she's single, probably. She's an older woman who's single. Her temptation
don't
could be,
call
hey,
me older. I'm 45.
Well,
that's a lot.
Well, anyway. So I think she, in a way, she's tempted too. I see a lot of temptation on her part because she, here's a friend that she's had for a long time, and she could pull him away from.
Exactly.
Pull him away from
boy, I've seen that.
That's what Frank Rogers said too, was that that Sandy is so recognizable as someone who needs to have her own life choices validated by someone coming up behind.
And it's really easy to make the big separation choice, which Sandy is.
So, yeah. Sandy is the been there, done that. Listen to me, because I'm the one doing.
And if you'll do this, I'll feel better about what I've done. We're 10 minutes over here. Thank you. It was very nice to be read.
We're just getting started.
Well, I'll come back tomorrow and we'll return to some endings here. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, I can come back tomorrow, but I'll be in Los Angeles. So.
Sin City.
We'll do a telephone conference.
You can find the Temptations.
Thank you.
I love it. Sin City.
You often combine characters, haven't you, in some of your plays, like Luke being both the old Luke and also a and their movement would be important, where you could either have them dressed or something as Luke the narrator, but also Luke the hand on shoulder,
I don't want to be her pastor. Is he somebody? He's a guy who opened a food center and not gets the job, and she becomes the interim director. Is he a guy who
moves on?
Dealing with real temptations.
A religious brother.
Yeah.
I have a little trouble.
I think that character is waiting to be.
If not a religious brother, or an ordained deacon, ordained deacon or something like that, who
talking
who just,
almost
is
like
a presence, and somehow
is very clear in his caring for her. There's no sexual romantic, you know, interest or whatever, but wants to just be there with her. You could even have him then, you know, to make that as a congregational participation thing, if he has some kind of movement or ritual movement that he does to her all the time, you could have a couple of even the actors out in the congregation, sitting in the congregation, who even respond from the congregation even, so I'm like, oh my God, this is just like me, and as he goes out, as he walks out, you know, he just touches them and moves on or whatever.
Or maybe he even gives the peace of the Lord or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Yeah.
What an exciting idea.